Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of leadership is required to reunite Americans politically and socially? As different segments of the U.S. population worry about unsustainable government spending, military conflict, income inequality, and economic stagnation, it appears neither of the nation's two parties has all the answers, even as both are deeply influenced by moneyed interests trying to influence public policy. Having once played a key role in the legislative process, my guest today is convinced it is still possible to move past the numerous stalemates that keep lawmakers from accomplishing what is needed. Bill Bradley served as U.S. Senator from New Jersey from 1979 until 1997 and ran for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2000. He's currently a managing director of the financial services company Allen & Company, LLC, and hosts a weekly satellite radio show called American Voices. His new book is We Can All Do Better. Senator Bradley, welcome to Think.
It's great to be back.
You were saying near the end of your time in the Senate that American politics was broken. How are things even worse today?
Well, I think they're worse because money has an even bigger role. I mean, when I ran for the Senate for the first time in 1978, I spent $1.68 million on the primary and general election. And the person who replaced me in 2000 spent $63 million, much of it his own money. So money is playing, you extrapolate from that to the whole system, and you see the crisis that we're in because of the role of money in politics. For example, between in 2009-2010, the financial industry contributed $318 million to politicians in Washington, the healthcare industry $145, and the energy industry $75. So it shouldn't be any wonder that, you know, the health care bill did not have a public option, that we had watered down financial reform, and that we didn't even get to an energy bill, even as we send billions of dollars to autocrats on the other side of the world to feed our oil habit. So money is one of the major differences.
So, of course, Citizens United, that decision by the Supreme Court, has changed a lot with regard to allowing unlimited corporate campaign contributions. The question, though, is, assuming that not everyone on Capitol Hill is corrupt, why can't we trust our politicians to accept what money they're given and not allow that money to influence what they're doing?
Well, I think clearly everyone on Capitol Hill isn't corrupt. I mean, I think there are a lot of very fine servants, the public servants, that are caught in a terrible system. And it's the dynamic of the system that is the problem. And I think that you can have good people who are trapped in a bad system, and unless you change the system, you're not going to get what you should get as a country. And I think that's where we are now.
Still, the decision would only be reversible by constitutional amendment. How do we convince members of Congress to put concerted effort into eliminating something that has trapped them in this system and is such an enormous source of the funding now that keeps them employed?
I think that the role of citizens are absolutely critical here. You know, in 2008, on that election night in Chicago, we made a mistake of believing that a leader can renew the country all by himself. I mean, it takes even somebody who moved us and touched us as deeply as Barack Obama can't do it alone. It takes sergeants and lieutenants. It takes citizens out there who are going to make a difference in the community. And in this case, the current role of money in politics and need for constitutional amendment, it will only take place if there's citizen involvement. And the point is, we've been there before. For example, in the 1830s, there were a group of people in America who felt that slavery was immoral. They were called abolitionists. In the 1880s, there were a group of people who believed women ought to have a right to vote. They were called suffragists. In the 1950s, there were a group of people that said the Constitution ought to guarantee full equality for African Americans. They were called civil rights workers. In the 1970s, there were a group of people who said we need to clean up our air and our water. They were called environmentalists. None of these movements began in the mind of a politician. It began with citizens who said, in our system, we can affect change, and they did. And one might also point out that in the 19th century, when corrupt state legislatures and selected U.S. senators sent corrupt senators to Washington, often on the payrolls of railroads and banks, the people rose up. And over a 10-year period, they passed a constitutional amendment so that today it's the people who elect U.S. senators, not state legislatures. So we've been there before. We've done it in the past. And it's absolutely critical to freeing our legislatures to do what they really should be doing.
You reinforce the point here that politics is separate and apart from the existence of government. And that should be obvious to anyone who's taken a civics course in high school, but we do tend to forget it in this country.
That politics is separate from what?
From government.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, people get politics and government mixed up. And there's a view now that government is the problem. Well, are there excesses in government? Are there inefficiencies? Clearly. But where would we be without government? I mean, if you look around, you drive on a highway, that happens to be government. You take medicine, Federal Drug Administration makes sure it's not poison. You fly on an airplane, Federal Aviation Administration assures that you're not going to crash. And that's before we even get to national parks or Medicare or Social Security or the national defense. So to say that, you know, we don't need government is to ignore the reality that our whole economy stands on the foundation of far-sighted good government.
You tell us that your aim with this book is to restore hope in America, and obviously it's an emotion that we all like to have, but what changes when we're confident that it's really possible to make things better?
Well, what changes is we actually get legislation that addresses the real issues that confront the American people. Right now, given the way we draw congressional district lines, it empowers the extremes in each party. Because out of 435 congressional seats, only about 50 are competitive. So that means that if I'm in a 60-40 district, I don't even have to listen to Republicans if I'm a Democrat, or vice versa. What I have to worry about is a challenge in my primary from the left or from the right if you're a Republican, and therefore you play to those extremes. And unless you do that, if you decide you're going to actually try to negotiate and compromise to make things happen in America, you often are taken out by the extremes. Senator Dick Lugar, for example, a Republican, Indiana, was taken out by a Tea Party Republican who said when he was elected, the era of collegiality is over, the era of confrontation has begun, and my view of how we should proceed our success in the Senate will be when Democrats agree with my points of view. In other words, compromise is out. It demonstrates a massive ignorance of American history. I mean, we wouldn't have a Constitution without compromise. We wouldn't have been able to buy the Louisiana Purchase without compromise that allowed the federal government to assume the debts of the state and establish the creditworthiness of the United States in George Washington's administration. I mean, you know, the idea that you can only have your view and the other view you never consider is, I think, a recommendation for paralysis.
Do you think that American voters are less tolerant of compromise than they once were?
I think there are some American voters who have mirrored the view of the guy that won the election in Indiana. I mean, I think that they, from my perspective, are primarily people on the far right. Are there some Democrats who have extreme views or are unwilling to compromise? Yes, but I think the majority are Republicans, the far right variety. For example, and I think that the key thing here is to break the logjam. And I talk about citizen movements, and people say, well, we had the Tea Party, we have Occupy, and yet they are two totally different things. I mean, not only ideologically different. If you take the Tea Party movement, I mean, essentially they were very well-funded, and they had a very clear objective, which was roll back government. And they also had a strategy, which was get involved in congressional races immediately. And in 2010, they elected 43 members of the House who were Tea Party Republicans. And those Tea Party Republicans, when Speaker Boehner and President Obama had an agreement on principle for a $3 trillion deficit reduction package, and Boehner took the agreement back to the House, the 43 Tea Party Republicans are the ones that vetoed that and brought the country to the brink of bankruptcy. So for people who say things can't change, 3 years before, nobody ever heard of the Tea Party. And so they made a profound change in the whole situation with the country. On the other hand, you take Occupy. They had a great slogan, we're the 99%. They called attention to an issue that's very important, income inequality in our country. But they didn't have an objective. They did not have a strategy to grab the levers of power. And as a result, the Tea Party has been much more influential in politics than has the Occupy movement. So here the lesson is, a passion is great, it's important to have it, but you need passion married to a strategy to grab the levers of power if you're going to affect change in the United States. For example, in the 1960s, Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King had a moral vision, had a dream, and it touched millions and tens of millions of Americans. But for that dream to become reality, it took a president, Lyndon Johnson, who converted the dream, made it permanent by putting it into law. So you need passion and vision, and you also need knowledge on how to pull the levers of power to affect your desired end.
You've talked about this idea that perhaps the country needs a third party, at least on Capitol Hill. Talk about who that party would represent and what it might stand for.
Well, you know, there have been times in American history when political points of view were irreconcilable. The time right before the Civil War comes to mind. But usually our conflicts are resolved with political combat. It may be vicious, but it's bloodless. And in the end, one of three things happen. Either one party dominates, for example, the Democrats in 1964, or you have a divided government, a narrow majority of one party or the other, which is what it was during the 18 years I was in the Senate, and even to a certain extent today, where unless you have bipartisan cooperation, you're not going to get the people's work done. If neither of those produce what people really need in this country, and there I would say the major question is, you know, the circumstance of middle-class Americans who are stuck and have had stagnant incomes for 30 years, if we can't address their situation, then you're going to have potentially the emergence of a third congressional party. Now, this would not be a presidential party. It's not Ross Perot. It's not Ralph Nader. But it's a congressional party only. And if they had a very specific objective, maybe a constitutional amendment on money would be an example, maybe some very big deficit reduction package plus an infrastructure program. They had three or four very specific objectives, and they said, we're running in 50 districts, and this is our agenda. Elect us, and we will seek to get this passed. And they got 20 seats out of the 50 that are competitive in the Congress. They could sit at the fulcrum of power in the Congress and make trades to get their objective, which would be the people's objective, accomplished. And it just might break up the logjam that's in the Congress now between the two parties.
My guest is Senator Bill Bradley. He is currently host of a SiriusXM radio show called American Voices, and he's author of the new book, We Can All Do Better. We'll come back to our conversation in just a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former U.S. Senator Bill Bradley. He served the state of New Jersey from 1979 until 1997 and ran for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2000. He's currently a managing director of Allen & Company, LLC, and hosts a weekly satellite radio show called American Voices. We're talking this hour about his new book, We Can All Do Better. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Steve in Dallas, who writes, "Maybe I was just not listening in years previous, but this fight over raising the debt ceiling has never seemed at such a stalemate, and it's frustrating that an event that has historically seemed a given has become so contested. I link it," writes Steve, "to the Republican statement that Obama will be a one-term president." What do you think about that, Senator Bradley?
Well, that is specifically what the majority leader of the Senate, the former majority leader, minority leader, Mitch McConnell, actually said. He said that his objective was to make Obama one-term president. And I think that the debt limit battle is an example of what extremes certain Republicans are prepared to go to effect that end. The debt limit is not something new, and posturing on the debt limit is not new. I mean, you know, when I was in the Senate, there were always senators who would say, "I'll never vote for the debt limit." And they would vote against the debt limit and go back to their district and say, "See, I'm against spending." But there were always enough people in both parties who recognized that what was at stake, and it was the full faith and credit of the United States government, that passed the debt limit with a bipartisan vote. It has never been just one party only. And when Republicans were in control of the Senate, there would be some Democrats that would posture and vote against it. When Democrats are in control of the Senate, there would be some Republicans who would posture and vote against it. But we always had bipartisan support to do what is essential to the health of the country. And that's how this changed. And I only know what Mitch McConnell said. I don't really know the motives, but there it is. He said that his objective was Obama as a one-term president, when I think the objective of most legislatures would be to serve the country.
Is there any way to get the federal budget back in line without both cutting spending and building tax revenues?
No. There is no way to get it without doing both those things. The big items in the federal budget are the defense budget, entitlements such as Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and then taxes. And unless you're able to touch all three of those things, you will not get the progress on the deficit that our economy so desperately needs. And that's not, you know, cutting the budget in the next 2 years, but it's passing today changes in, say, Social Security, where you might have the retirement age over for 30 years or 40 years raised to 69. And, you know, if you made those changes, then the long-term deficit would be coming down. If you made changes in the way we contract for defense systems, you could show the deficit trending down. If you raise some taxes, you could see that trending down over time. And that's what the market has to see. It has to see not that we get a big cut in the budget this year or next year, because if we do that, we're ultimately going to cut the things that hurt us all, like infrastructure and education and things that are central to our functioning in the government, in the country. But if you're able to cut these other items over the long term, you then send the message that we have things under control. And if we fail to do this, and I think our window of opportunity is in November and December of this year, when if there is not agreement under current law, there will be across-the-board cuts in defense and domestic programs and tax increases. And so if there's not cooperation, this is what we're going to have at the end of this year.
You have suggested that we at least look seriously at lowering corporate tax rates. First of all, how much lower would you set them, and what do you imagine the effect would be of that?
In the book, what I do is I enumerate the various kinds of taxes that could be raised. And one of them, here I suggest this is primarily a European phenomena, and maybe it's going to be something acceptable, maybe it wouldn't, is you lower corporate taxes, you raise individual tax rates. So you lower corporate tax rates so that they can hire more people. You raise individual tax rates so that those who have more pay more. That's one alternative. But in the book, what I really explore, and the only tax program, personally, I like two kinds of taxes. One, if you lower rates, income tax rates, and close loopholes. Mm-hmm. That's the Tax Reform Act of 1986 that I think was critical to the functioning of the country. But where we are now, I hear that, you know, the administration wants to do tax reform, but they haven't defined it. I hear the Republican head of the Ways and Means Committee wants to do tax reform, but he hasn't defined it. So, to me, what we need now, because I think the central issue that we face as a country is not enough people are working, and the income that they're making is not sufficient to support their family. For example, the median income in 2010, the median income in 2010 was the same as it was in 1996, no change. And middle income has been stagnant for nearly 30 years. And, of course, what happened was you then had a second earner. The wife or husband went into the workforce to add a paycheck to the family till. When that wasn't enough, people borrowed on their home as if it were a raise. And then you got to 2007, 2008 when the housing values crashed. And you had people who were really stuck, and they were angry, and legitimately so. So I think the main thing is how do we create an economy where we're generating good-paying jobs for the vast majority of Americans.
Talk about your ideas for infrastructure investment, because it sounds in many ways like something like the measures that were undertaken in the Roosevelt administration.
Well, yeah, I think you can't talk about the infrastructure, and this is often the problem when you talk about issues, because you talk about a single silo, one issue, but everything is linked. So if you think the objective is more people working at better pay, how do you do that? The first thing you do is immediately you pass a law that says if a company hires a worker and doesn't lay anyone else off, that the federal government will pay 30% of that cost, up to $50 billion, first come, first serve. The beauty of that is not one taxpayer dollar is spent unless a job is created.
Mm-hmm.
And once you do that, you then have to look at the midterm. And in the midterm, we have to be aware that non-financial corporations in America have $1.8 trillion in cash and liquid assets on their books. If 20% of that was used to hire people at the median wage, around $49,000 a year, unemployment would drop from 8-point-whatever-it-is-now to 5%. And so when you ask CEOs, why aren't you hiring people, they give you two reasons. They say, one, uncertainty. I don't know about the future. I need a rainy day fund. And number two, there's not enough demand out there in the economy. So I don't want to produce 10 widgets if demand is only for 5 widgets. And so you have to address each of those. You address the long-term uncertainty by doing deficit reduction that I just described earlier in the program. And you address the demand question by a massive infrastructure program of $1 trillion over 5 years. And that would be for 50 nationally significant projects, such as a new air traffic control system for the country. I mean, right now you go to the airport, those guys in the towers who are the traffic controllers, they're looking at TVs with red dots crossing, just like they were doing in the 1960s. It's way out of date. We would dramatically improve on time, we would dramatically improve on delays, we'd dramatically improve on productivity because people wouldn't be stuck in airports, as so many of us are from time to time. So if you did the infrastructure program, that would create the demand, it would create 5 million jobs, those would be good jobs, people would be spending, and as they were buying widgets, then the company that had all the cash on its books would say, well, I ought to hire a few more people in order to produce the widgets. Because now there's a demand for it. And the result would be a virtuous circle up as opposed to a virtuous spiral up as opposed to the spiral down, which we're now confronting in our country.
Do we need to get comfortable with the idea that we might have to finance such infrastructure investment by expanding our debt to China?
Well, it's interesting. If you did all the things that I've suggested, you would be reducing the deficit over time. Because you would do taxes, entitlements, and defense. beginning year three or four, right? Long term, mm-hmm. which is what the market has to see, which is what the bond market has to see. And that means we would need to borrow less money to finance our immediate deficit. But we got to remember who's lending us money. Well, the Chinese have lent us $1.4 trillion to help finance our deficits. So now we won't have to borrow as much from the Chinese. But what the Chinese can do then, because they'll still have dollars, we're still buying their goods, they then could buy reconstruction bonds. They could be core investors in the $200 billion a year in reconstruction bonds to produce this massive infrastructure program that would lay the foundation for economic growth in the 21st century.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phones now with Ron in Dallas. Hello, Ron.
Yes, Mr. Radley. Hi. I really do feel, and I've not worked with the Reform Party and with Perot, and I've worked with the Republican Party, and I've backed away because I became very disillusioned by absolutely nobody trying to think out of the box to try and help some of the problems with America. It just seems like and I know so little is done with legislature, and there is deadlock constantly, and maybe that's a good thing that they don't pass anything sometimes. As a small businessman, some of the legislation, just the threat of legislation, puts me in a tailspin about what the hell to expect next time around. Excuse my language. But there has to be some way to get people that are elected to stop having to pay back for all the things that they had to promise to get into that office. And really, if you have to lock them in a room, make them come up with a good idea. Make them do something that's out of the box. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's raising the taxes. I don't know if it's cutting social programs, but there is far too much of the infrastructure of America that's falling down. We're shipping off our raw materials to China, and they're shipping it right back to us. And I don't have an answer. I really don't. But
well, let's get a response for you, Ron, because I think you put a lot of frustration out on the table there that I'm sure Senator Bradley has heard before.
Yes, of course I have. Ron's circumstance is the circumstance of millions of Americans who are fed up and frustrated and don't know what to do. And that's really one of the reasons I wrote this book, which was to give people some hope that there are things we can do, to lay out specifically what we can do, and to suggest a plan forward. And I would say to him that one of the key phrases you had in your comments was that the people who run for election and promise things and then they get to Washington and do it. I would suggest to you that if we, in terms of the special interest, and I would say that if we had a constitutional amendment that would free a lot of politicians to be legislators only. When I was in the Senate, when I came to the Senate, used to be a senator for 4 years. He ran for re-election 2 years. Now you got to raise money for 6 years, and you're a constant candidate. And that's not good. If we were able to reduce the role of money in politics with a constitutional amendment and public financing congressional and Senate races, we would then be able to have legislators addressing the substantive needs that you point out. And in the book, I lay out what I think government should do, not to burden the private sector, but to liberate the private sector. And my intention is to give people a path forward here. And as I suggested earlier in the program, to the extent neither party is going to do the things that the majority of people want to have done, improve their ability to hire, you're a small businessman, improve your ability to hire people and to pay them enough, well, then the public is going to look for something else, and that could be the emergence of a third congressional party that, as I said, could shake the whole system up if there were three or four specific objectives that it had.
We have an email here from Sharyar, who wants to know if you've thought about running as a third-party candidate yourself.
No, I think that Sharyar's email confuses, running as a congressman. Because I'm not proposing a third party for president. I'm proposing a third party for Congress. And, one of the reasons I did this book was to be a catalyst for citizens to recognize that there are things they could do, a third party being one of them, if they have an agreement on specific items, maybe two or three, that they want to have accomplished.
Do you have colleagues and former colleagues, I should say, in the Senate who would privately say, yes, we agree with you, but we cannot say this aloud because we are in office right now?
I think that there are many people in the Congress that would like to be liberated from having to spend 2 to 3 hours a day calling strangers to get money.
Right.
I think they would welcome that. The problem is that they step forward and do public financing right now, and for $3 billion a year, we could take the special interest totally out of politics. And if you compare $3 billion to the budget of $3.5 trillion, probably the best investment the American public will ever have made. But they don't support that now because they need to have the support of the various interests in financing of their campaigns. The witness, the numbers I mentioned earlier, $318 million in 2009 of the financial industry alone. And so that's where the public comes in. I mean, democracy is not a vicarious experience. And in the Internet age, apathy should not be an option. And that means taking control of the situation and passing a constitutional amendment that will allow politicians no longer to be the tools of special interests. And many of them are, even if the money are not tools, but unfortunately the system produces the result that we have. And it would free them up to use their energy to listen to their constituents and to think through policy ideas that can actually meet the real needs of the country.
My guest is former U.S. Senator Bill Bradley. His new book is called We Can All Do Better. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes and take more of your calls and emails. The phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Former U.S. Senator Bill Bradley is my guest. His new book is called We Can All Do Better. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. What criteria, Senator Bradley, should be met before we consider committing U.S. troops and U.S. resources to what could be extended military conflicts?
I think we have to ask ourselves, what are the challenges of the 21st century? And in the 21st century, I believe economics is going to be determinant of national power more than military actions. So I think we have to be very circumspect about committing forces to faraway lands. And I think this is particularly relevant in the context of China. The reality is that China is an economic competitor, but it needn't be a military adversary. And so I think we need to focus on strengthening our economy, producing more jobs, higher pay for our people, better education for our citizens. That's what will determine the future of this country. Lee Kuan Yew, for example, who is the former Prime Minister of Singapore, says in the 21st century, intelligence will decide the success of a country. And there's no question about that. So I think that we have to look at what's happened in the last 12 years, the two wars we had in Iraq and Afghanistan still going on. What has been the cost of those, the opportunity cost? Well, compare those last 12 years with what's happened in China. And the front page of the New York Times in October of last year, on the same day, same front page, two stories side by side, caught our circumstance. One was a story that had a headline that said, Europeans go to China to ask for investment in Euro Rescue Fund. China, then, the story goes on to say, would not consider providing that money to Europe unless Europe agreed to change China's status under the WTO, World Trade Organization, so that it made China less likely that they would ever be sanctioned under the rules of the organization.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it was the story of a burgeoning economic power that had massive reserves exercising that power in the world, like we used to do. And then you have a story right next to it that said, Western business looks for investment in Libya. In other words, it was the story of us picking over the bones of our latest Mideast adventure. One was the story about a country that understands the 21st century is about economics. And the other is the story of a country that might have lost its way. Doesn't mean we shouldn't fight terrorism. Of course we should. Doesn't mean we shouldn't have a strong navy. Of course we should. Doesn't mean we shouldn't have a doubtful land forces. Of course we should. But we have to be very circumspect about commitment of military forces around the world. You saw President Obama say recently that we were increasing the number of military personnel in Australia. Well, why didn't the Chinese react to that? Because it's clearly aimed at, you know, a military presence in Asia. The answer is because the Chinese know what the game is in the 21st century. They can get whatever they need from Australia, which are resources, because the Australians want to sell the resources, and China wants to buy them. And that will increasingly be the basis of power in the 21st century. So we have to wake up and make that investment in our citizens.
How could we make ourselves more competitive with regard to keeping, say, foreign-born professionals who are educated in this country?
Well, I think that, you know, the Lee Kuan Yew quote, which says that in the 21st century, intelligence will determine who will be the winner. And he goes on to say, the Chinese have a talent pool of 1.3 trillion people. I'm sorry, 1.3 billion people.
Mm-hmm.
And he says the U.S. has a talent pool of 7 billion people.
Right.
Meaning, because we have immigration, we can attract the brightest minds from all over the world to come help build our economy, to develop the new thing, to have exist, you know, teach in our schools if we need them to teach. For example, the mayor of Chicago told me he was hiring math teachers from Eastern Europe and China. And the reality is that as long as we remain open, that doesn't mean, you know, anybody immigrates into the United States. It simply means that, you know, we have a regular flow. We get for talented people. We allow people who want to build a better future in this country. That, you know, down the road, the immigration issue is terribly important in this. And I understand in Texas how sensitive the issue is. But at the same time, you have to look at what the real issue is. The issue is that we're not having as many children in this country as we used to. We're not even replacing the children, the people who are dying, with births in this country. And that means we're not going to have enough workers. We're going to go into a situation that's unlike anything we've ever experienced. Since the Depression, a problem of public policy has been a labor shortage. And that means unemployment, and that's what we aim to avoid. There still is too much unemployment, and some of the things I've talked about relate to that. But in the next 30 years or 50 years, there will be a labor shortage. And so that means that there are not going to be enough workers paying money into the Social Security system to keep the promises that we're making to be working people today, that they'll have Social Security. Absent additional workers. And that's where regular flow of talented people into the United States is what we need in order to finance our Medicare Social Security system and keep our promises to the elderly. It's also what we need to produce the new things that will keep us on the cutting edge of change.
There are too many arguments against bringing in people who are highly qualified and highly educated from other countries. What approach do we need to take to workers who want to live and work here but bring far less specialized job skills with them?
Well, I think there has to be a regular flow. I think the relationship with Mexico is critical. I think some form of guest worker program would be appropriate. I think a limited number of people from countries around the world who have aspirations, just as the immigrants in the past, who will come and work, 30, 50 hours a week. That's very important. And I think that if you look at, just look at your situation in Dallas. I mean, who babysits for your kids? Who takes care of the elderly parents? Who does your lawns? Who does the bricklaying? Who does some of the construction? A lot of this are immigrants. And so we have to understand a regularized flow is important. We can't keep everybody out. It wouldn't be in our interest to. We can't open up the gates and let anybody flood in. We can't. So you need a balance. And right now there are laws in the books to deal with illegal immigrants. And the law says, the current law, no more legislation, is that if you hire an illegal immigrant, then you incur a fine. If you do it two or three times, you incur prison time. So the idea is employer responsibility here.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Stan in Arlington. Hi, Stan.
The Republicans are aiming to make Obama a one-term president, but if he is reelected, he will not be just a one-term president. I'm curious about Bill Bradley's views as to what the Republicans will be aiming at in that case.
The question was what the Republicans will be aiming at if Obama is reelected?
Yes.
Well, that's a real window of opportunity, and we'll see that in this period between the election and the second inauguration. And I think that you could find a number of Republicans who will be willing to make some compromises for the country. I haven't lost all hope for some Republicans. Because, if you look at Republicans, there are, how many, 30, 40, 50, who know that the extreme position is being taken on a very partisan basis for this election is not really in the interest of the country. And I think they could moderate. I think they could then be a part of a bipartisan coalition. I think President Obama ought to also take a page out of Lyndon Johnson's book. And by that, I mean the following. He should have his staff now identify the 30 to 50 Republicans who, by background, education, previous statements, would be considered candidates to be bipartisan. He should know more about them than their mothers. And then he should invite them individually to join in, say, a gigantic deficit reduction or the big economic thing that will get middle income rising, and make the appeal on patriotism. He is the president. He can call people to higher ground, and he will not be running for another election. And Republicans, then, I think, could be given the opportunity to come over. And to the extent that somebody doesn't come over, the president then would make the telephone calls to their biggest contributors, to the biggest businesses in their district, to their ministers, to their brothers, and to their mothers. And I guarantee you, and the message would be, look, he's a Republican, I'm a Democrat, but on this one vote, it's absolutely critical that we unite as a country. And my guess is that he'd be able to pull some votes over to make it a bipartisan agreement. So I haven't lost hope in a second term. I've been a little disappointed in the first term, more than a little disappointed, because I thought there would be a greater opportunity. But in the event that there still is this recalcitrance, you then are you're headed toward, I think, the thing I talked about earlier, the emergence of a third party in the Congress.
Do individual voters, you call them voters, we call them listeners or viewers or readers, do they have a role to play in the polarization of political coverage in this country?
Well, yeah, I don't think that, you know, there are people, there are television channels that play explicitly to the ideological views of their listeners. And they have polled them, they know what they want, and they feed it to them. And so, yes, I mean, you get a far right, you get a left, and, you know, the whole angle is slanting it to particular voters who call in and reinforce what they already believe by what they see. So I think that on that level, yeah, people are responsible. People say, well, negative advertising works because people respond to it. Well, to a certain extent, that's true, but that'll change as soon as somebody does it a different way, and then politics, which is fundamentally an imitative profession, that this new way of doing it will be imitated. I think that the people are important here in the following sense, and I write about this in the book at some length. When I ran for president, I talked about the goodness of the American people, such as the guy that shined shoes in the Pittsburgh Children's Hospital for 46 years, and out of every tip, he put a portion of that tip into a fund to pay for poor kids' health care. The day I interviewed him, he'd put over $100,000 into that fund. Now, that's the selflessness that characterizes America. I've done over 300 shows on Sirius XM, and after about 30, I had an executive come to me and say, what are you going to do when you run out of stories about people like this? I said, I'm never going to run out of stories. This is America. And I think where the people come is we must never forget that's who we are. We are a selfless people. We are people who help our neighbors. Everything from when we raised the barns in the 18th century to today, where a guy in Pittsburgh is contributing money to pay for poor kids' health care. And in every community in America, there are citizens who give to their neighbors. And I believe that that is really the call, and that's the call to higher ground. And it goes both ways. A leader can point that out, and then the people can continue to be that selfless foundation upon which good public policy can be built.
Bill Bradley served as U.S. Senator from New Jersey from 1979 until 1997. He is currently a managing director of the financial services company Allen & Company, LLC, and he hosts a weekly satellite radio show called American Voices. His new book is We Can All Do Better. Senator Bradley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.